Hello and welcome to Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 12255. Every Monday and Tuesday, it's our weekly programme of technical news and features. And this week on Sparks, a right weird bunch, electronic smog, digital shortwave radio receivers, we profile Sir William Siemens, analogue recordings on a chip, and of course your letters. Stay tuned.
Out the country, now I find you longing in your soft and fertile dew, and I whisper thoughts to satisfy your longing for the warmth and tender shelter of my body. Oh, you're mine, yes, you're mine.
Something from the science programme on the BBC World Service about the effects of very high RF fields, rapidly becoming known as electronic smog.
Radiation, including domestic appliances, computers, walkie-talkies, cell phones, pagers, microwave data links, and so on. The conference highlighting the hazards of electronic pollution was organised by AEA Technology, one of Europe's largest research organisations. John Wilson, our science unit, has been telling me about the serious effects of electronic smog.
One of the real problems, and it's a growing problem now, is that we have a lot of electronic equipment which actually operates in areas where life can be threatened. Electronic medical equipment, electronic equipment managing the engines and braking systems in cars, electronic navigation equipment in aircraft. And obviously, if that is interfered with, then there is a great potential for loss of life.
Is there evidence that there has been severe damage or disaster caused by electronic smog?
Only circumstantial. We've, for example, got tentative evidence. There was evidence during the Gulf War that a lot of the electronic systems in weapons and aircraft and so on interfered with each other. The difficulty is, of course, that electronic radiation, electromagnetic radiation, is not something that leaves any evidence that it's been around, so you can only hazard a guess that it was responsible. But certainly, I think there is evidence of bombs, for example, or weapons in general being detonated prematurely because of electronic smog. I mean, one example is a big American American rocket that actually took off prematurely. Some suggest because of electromagnetic radiation that affected the launching equipment.
Right, well, you've established it is a major problem, so what can be done about it?
Well, in the case of accidental emission from things like power tools and faulty lights, you can do quite a lot to fit equipment to suppress it. And there's quite a lot of work going on in Europe and elsewhere at the moment. There is a directive limiting the maximum amount of this accidental radiation, and the conference has been discussing that. In the case of deliberate radiation from radio transmitters and mobile telephones, obviously you can't do anything. So the problem then has to transfer to the destination, the equipment that's being affected. And there is a lot of work going on now to making medical equipment, navigation equipment, less susceptible to the effects of electromagnetic radiation. I think that's where the main bulk of the work will happen.
The conference heard something about a new test.
Well, a new test facility which is being set up in Britain, where you can bombard equipment with electromagnetic deliberately to see what effect it has. And if the equipment turns out to be too susceptible, then you go away and redesign it. There are lots of things you can actually do with susceptible equipment. You can redesign the wiring layout. You can fit suppression capacitors at critical places. You can use different types of semiconductors in order to minimize the susceptibility. And this is really where a lot of the work is going on today.
John Wilson, and I hope that came through quite clearly without any effects of electronic smog.
That was from BBC World Service.
A letter here from David Ashmore in Leyland, Preston, Lancashire. He writes, "Since I purchased my new Sony SW7600 shortwave radio a month ago, I have tuned into RadioFax. The signal is so weak I can only just hear it. My other shortwave radio won't even pick up the transmission. But on Tuesday, I discovered that by placing my radio near a copper gas pipe, the signal came in loud and clear. So now I can listen every day. I found the programs very interesting." Well, thanks, David. That's a good tip. I use that myself. Isn't technology wonderful?
Yeah. Behold New York City. I said I love you to death, so you don't stop and you don't quit. You got to keep on until the dip do it like this. You don't stop and you don't quit. You got to keep on and on and on.
Sir William Siemens, European engineer. From the IEEE News, William Siemens was born in Menzendorf, a small village in Mecklenburg, in 1823, and was one of four brothers who were to make the name of Siemens synonymous with technical progress. As a boy and young man, William was brought up by Werner, who saw to it that he was properly educated and trained as an engineer. In 1842, at the tender age of 19, William was sent to England by Werner to sell his patented gold plating process. It turned out to be an excellent decision for Siemens. The Victorian age of splendid isolation was in full flower, and Great Britain was regarded by the continent as wealthy, highly industrialised, and indeed the workshop of the world. The social climate was generous to the Germans because of Queen Victoria's success in ending the personal union with Hanover. Also, Blücher's assistance in the victory over Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo had not been forgotten. England was blooming in manufacturing industry, technical advances, and industrial exports, having recovered from the economic crisis of the late 1830s. This environment greeted William on his arrival, and he promptly made his mark by selling Werner's patent to the renowned industrialist Richard Elkington. He returned to Germany with the princely sum of £1,500 in his pocket. Encouraged by this early success, he emigrated to Britain in 1844 at the age of 21, with the hope of cultivating further contacts and opening up new business opportunities. This decision was taken in conjunction with Werner, who authorised him to make use of all his patents and other developed ideas as he wished. It was the start of what was to become a remarkable and extremely happy life in Britain. In 1859 he married Anne Gordon, and at the same time he became a naturalised British subject. At that time he joked that he had sworn his obedience to two women on the same day, to Victoria, Queen of Great Britain, and to Anne, Queen of his heart. He was knighted as Sir William Siemens in 1883 and died the same year. William achieved much in Britain. Even though he was a foreigner, public opinion honoured him in his lifetime and in a still more striking manner after his death. By the diffusion and application of scientific knowledge, he helped the country in the development of its industrial arts. He also contributed to the work of numerous associations which laid the foundations of sound preliminary technical education. William's work was considerably assisted by uninterrupted and close connections with his brothers. Furthermore, his marriage to Anne Gordon made it easier to be accepted by British society. As time passed, he became increasingly anglicised in outlook, but never lost his close ties to his family and homeland in Germany. In Germany, Werner was concentrating on the company he had founded in Berlin with Johann Georg Halske in 1847. In England, preparations were in full swing for the Great Exhibition in Hyde Park in 1851, one of the most illustrious events in industrial history. This prompted Siemens and Halske to appoint William as their British representative, and the contract was signed in 1850. It marks the official start of Siemens's commercial ties with the British Empire. Siemens received the Council Medal, the highest token of merit, for its dial telegraph displayed at the Great Exhibition. However, it was a water meter and not this telegraph which led to large-scale trade in Britain. The first water meter was patented by William in 1851 under number 1000 and manufactured in Rotherham. A further model was developed and manufactured with meticulous care in the Berlin company, which acquired a high reputation in England for precision engineering. In 1853, Werner sent his 24-year-old brother Karl to St. Petersburg as a permanent representative. This was another fortunate appointment, which finally resulted in the opening up of the East European market to German industrial products. Together with Werner, Karl and William made a formidable team. Scientific research and development of new technical processes were William's preferred interests. Karl was the born entrepreneur and pragmatic manager. Werner was the family head and primus inter pares. Rapid and reliable communication with the Empire were of urgent concern to Britain, and the spotlight was on submarine cable systems. In Germany, Siemens was leading with its experience of landlines. In 1857, the British ran into problems with laying their submarine cable between Sardinia and Bona in the Mediterranean, and called in Werner Siemens to help them. He promptly produced precise technical instructions, which were equally promptly described by the British as scientific humbug. But the measurement engineering controls recommended by Siemens did contribute greatly to the subsequent successful conclusion of the Sardinia to North Africa cable. In many ways, this work heralded the introduction of a new engineering technique, which would be called quality control nowadays. continuing with the life of Sir William Siemens. The British government appointed Siemens to act as its advisor on its still incomplete national submarine cable project. Werner had now whetted William's restless appetite for innovative work in this field, but his first attempt at cable laying on behalf of the French, also in the Mediterranean, was a near disaster. This was chiefly due to mechanical difficulties of laying the cable in stormy weather. The entire company of the cable expedition, including both Siemens' brothers and William's young wife, narrowly avoided losing their lives. Meanwhile, the London agency had been replaced by a British subsidiary, which was entered in the London Commercial Register on the 1st of October 1858. Halske resigned in 1865, and the name was then changed to Siemens Brothers. In 1863, the first Siemens cable factory had been erected in the vicinity of the Arsenal in Woolwich. It manufactured land and submarine cables and telegraph apparatus. Incidentally, the brilliant young Sebastian de Ferranti, who later founded the Ferranti Company, found his first job with Siemens in the Woolwich factory. Siemens Brothers built the Indo-European telegraph systems, which started in London and ran via Prussia, Russia and Persia to Bombay and Calcutta. Up to the time of its technical overhaul in 1931, the system was continuously in service. Indeed, some parts are still in use today in India. To meet the demand for overseas communications, Siemens Brothers commissioned William Fuder to build a special cable-laying ship to a design by William Siemens. It was christened Faraday by his wife Anne and was launched at the Mitchell Shipyard in Newcastle-upon-Tyne in 1874. In a long and successful service life of nearly 50 years, it was the prototype for many cable-laying ships. In 1866, Werner had discovered the electrodynamic principle, and the dynamo concept was developed as a source of electrical energy for practical applications. In 1881, William installed the first electric street lighting in the world, in Godalming, near Guildford, and followed this with lighthouse illumination, electric trains in Port Rush, that's Northern Ireland, and Brighton, and electric lighting in the London Stock Exchange. He even had electrically heated greenhouses at his residence in Tunbridge Wells. During his early years in Britain, William was joined by his brother Friedrich, who invented and patented the regenerative open hearth furnace. In 1879, he had already unveiled a model of an electric steel furnace. Later, and together with the French engineer Martin, the so-called Siemens-Martin process was developed. For the first time, this allowed the large-scale reclamation of scrap metal, and it is still one of the most economical smelting processes available to foundries. In 1871, William Siemens became the first president of the Society of Telegraph Engineers in Britain. In 1877, he was made president of the Iron and Steel Institute. This was all before the Elektrotechnischer Verein was founded in Berlin by Werner Siemens and Reichspostminister Stefan in 1879. A year later, the Society of Telegraph Engineers added "and electricians" to its name, and it was this society that adopted the title of the Institution of Electrical Engineers in 1888. It is perhaps symbolic that the preliminary meetings of the German centre of the IEE were held in the Siemens meter factory in Nuremberg. Sir William would no doubt have smiled in appreciation at the wheel turning full circle. If he were alive today, one could imagine his pleasure at the success of his society, the IEE, becoming one of the leading learned institutions of its kind in the world. By the beginning of this century, Siemens Brothers in Great Britain had become the largest of all Siemens companies, including Siemens in Germany, and had some 10,000 employees. It was Sir William Siemens who shaped the events leading up to this period, and he was mainly responsible for the progress and unique reputation which the company acquired during and after his lifetime. He was buried in Kensal Green Cemetery in London, and his deeds were commemorated with a service and a large window in Westminster Abbey, which unfortunately did not survive the war. As the lengthy obituary published in the Times on the 21st of November 1883 stated, Sir William Siemens was essentially an inventor. His patents were numerous and various. His experiments remain extremely curious and form another illustration of the extraordinary originality and resource of the intelligence, now prematurely quenched in death. That's a review of the life of Sir William Siemens from IEE News.
It's Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255. Fresh programmes start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday, and we can be heard Monday and Tuesday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. We'd love you to write to us. Write and tell us what you live, where you live and what you do. Or as well, you can enter the competition. To win the original articles broadcast by Sparks, or at least as many as I can cram into an envelope, write and tell me the first frequency that Radio Fax transmitted on over Easter of 88. And the clue is, it's not 6205, nor is it 12255. What was the first frequency we transmitted on? And you can win a complete set of Sparks articles. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. And here's a letter from Nicholas Macmillan, Boreham, Chelmsford in Essex. I'm writing to congratulate you on a couple of excellent programmes I've heard recently on 6205 kHz shortwave. Andy Bradgate's programme a couple of weeks ago was quite simply the most interesting and enjoyable bit of radio I've heard in about a year, since Radio Caroline's demise. Please, please, please force the man to do a regular programme. Another well-received programme is the weekly Sparks review of all things electrical. I had considered attempting to contact the spirits on a tape recorder, but I'm afraid I chickened out. I do feel it's important to say what you think, and I believe hearing Kylie, Jason and all the other pap on shortwave is not the idea I approve of. If I want to hear that sort of music, I can do so by simply tuning to an ILR, or heaven forbid, Radio 1. Free radio is always at its best when it offers something different to what is usually received on the airwaves. He writes, Radio Fax's sound quality is usually very good in Essex. You often pick up S8 to 9 on his shortwave ICF 2001D with a random length of long wire. He writes he's currently studying for a geography degree at the University of Wales. Well, Nicholas, I agree with your comments about music policy, and I'm going to play you your request, The Waterboys. Here's A Bang on the Ear.
Staring chicken soup. but I send her my love, the bang on the ear. Deborah broke my heart, and I the willing fool. I fell for her one summer on the road to Liverpool. Forever, but it was over within the year. Oh dear. But I sent her my love, the bang on the ear. House of me. We weathered it together, bound by a ball and chain. It started up in Fife, it ended up in tears. I sent her my love, the bang on the ear. Crystal was a rover from Canada, she did. We crossed swords in San Francisco, we both lived to tell the tale. I don't know now where she is. Oh, but if I had her here, I'd give her my love and a bang on the ear.
One of my favourites as well brings Radio Caroline flooding back. Sparks from Radiofax. Undersampling techniques simplify digital radio by sampling below the Nyquist rate with a new type of ADC. Designers can exploit the benefits of digital radio. By Richard A. Groshong and Steve Ruskek in Electronic Design. Digital techniques offer some inherent advantages in communication receiver design. These advantages, however, have been offset by both cost and dynamic range limitations of analog-to-digital converters. Consequently, designers continue to use analog circuitry, despite its associated complexity and lack of flexibility. But recent introductions of low-cost, highly linear ADCs, combined with a technique known as undersampling, make digital processing the architecture of choice. A review of receiver design shows how digital processing can improve performance. High-performance communication receivers invariably are superheterodyne designs. A typical example is a double conversion unit that uses a broadband front end and fixed frequency bandpass filters after conversion to an intermediate frequency. The input filter ensures the selectivity needed to prevent strong signals outside the receiver's normal tuning range from overloading the first mixer and generating spurious signals. The first mixer upconverts the received signal to the first intermediate frequency, which is high enough to simplify design of the broadband input filter, but low enough to permit use of a low-cost crystal filter. The first IF is typically well above the highest received frequency, so the broadband input filter can attenuate undesirable signals. Otherwise, these signals can feed through the first mixer and prevent the receiver's IF rejection specification from being met. The input filter must also reduce the undesired first mixer image response at frequencies twice the first IF away from the tuned frequency. The first IF bandpass filter protects the first IF amplifier from overloading on signals that are within the receiver tuning range but outside the desired receive signal bandwidth. This filter also attenuates the second mixer image response at twice the second IF away from the desired signal frequency. The first IF amplifier supplies just enough gain to allow a low receiver noise figure for good sensitivity and a low noise floor, while maintaining a high dynamic range. The second mixer down-converts the first IF to a frequency that permits the most receiver selectivity gain and signal processing at a reasonable cost. In the typical communication receiver, many second IF bandpass filters may be needed to support the desired operating modes and bandwidth requirements. Additional frequency conversion to baseband may also be required, as well as multiple demodulation modes or embedded modems. Analog hardware costs, however, generally increase with the number of receiver operating modes. Consequently, using a software reconfigurable digital signal processor for the second IF functions can reduce costs. Digital components can replace the second IF and baseband functions. Digital processing can also simplify the design of the receiver's analog front end. For example, the digital signal processing algorithms can perform the fine-tuning function, perhaps in 1 Hz steps, over a 1 kHz range. This would allow the receiver's variable injection synthesizer to tune its broadband input range in 1 kHz rather than 1 Hz steps. Also, the programmable digital filters can compensate the passband magnitude and phase response of the analog front-end filter, so a lower-cost filter can be used. The sample rate of the second IF ADC is an important factor. The digital signal processor's efficiency is largely determined by the sample rate, regardless of the algorithms used by the processor. The higher the sample rate, the lower the efficiency. Likewise, non-linearities in the sample and hold circuit will dominate the ADC's linear dynamic range, which consequently is affected by the second IF. Higher IF frequencies result in lower dynamic range. The digital signal processor designer, therefore, wants to use the lowest IF and sample rate possible to keep the receiver dynamic range and DSP efficiency high. On the other hand, the analog front-end designer wants a high IF and sample rate to control image responses and aliasing in the ADC, without a costly first IF filter. Both designers can be satisfied by using undersampling techniques. Spectrum crowding and the possibility of high power transmitters close to the receiver make high dynamic range a must. Specifically, typical HF receiver must be sensitive enough to receive a half a microvolt signal at the receiver input with a 10 dB signal to noise ratio in a 3 kHz bandwidth. However, the receiver must also be able to receive a 1 volt signal without significant distortion. Consequently, in-band dynamic range must be at least 126 dB. Unfortunately, a digital receiver's dynamic range is adversely affected by the fact that the bulk of the receiver gain must be ahead of the ADC and the second IF bandpass digital filters. The high gain is needed to drive the ADC at a sufficient level. In an analog design, on the other hand, the gain occurs after the second IF bandpass filters. In the digital design, this positioning means that undesired out-of-band signals can pass through the wide bandwidth receiver front end and saturate the amplifier and ADC. This must be avoided because ADC saturation generates many aliased in-band harmonic and intermodulation products that can block a weak signal. The solution lies in automatic gain control and the use of large word-length, highly linear ADCs. A low sampling rate is a key factor in the overall performance of a digital receiver. A cursory analysis would conclude that the ADC's sampling rate must be at least twice the IF frequency. In the case of a band pass signal, however, designers can use undersampling, which means sampling at a rate less than twice the highest frequency being converted. To understand why undersampling, also called harmonic or bandpass sampling, is an ideal technique in radio applications, designers must study the spectrum of a typical receiver IF signal. Although linearity, sample rate, and resolution are prime considerations when choosing an undersampling ADC for digital radio, low cost and convenience are also important, and designers must examine the device's performance for inputs beyond the typical sub-Nyquist frequency characterization. For instance, two examples of sampling ADCs are the AD679 and AD779. These converters are complete 14-bit, 100 kilosample per second devices that differ only in their digital interfaces. Graphs are specifically included showing the AD679's characteristics for signals beyond the Nyquist frequency. Signal-to-noise determines the dynamic range that the converter can realistically achieve. This figure, which is computed by analysing the ADC's output using fast Fourier transforms, is the RMS summation of quantization noise, jitter-induced noise, circuit noise, and THD. Based on the first six harmonics, the THD is minus 99.8 dB, which is essentially buried in the noise floor. The second half of that article, however, we'll leave that for a second programme. Pretty complicated, but I thought you'd be interested to know what the leading edge of shortwave radio design is at the moment.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. The time to wallow in the mire. China, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Set the night on fire.
have become a funeral pyre.
Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on.
Report from Scandinavia, August court date set for Radio Nova, by Stuart Ward. Kleist Nydahl, head of local community radio Radio Nova, will be prosecuted in August for breaking the broadcasting laws. This is the result of more than 1 year of campaigning by the station to get the radio laws changed. The station contravened the ban on commercial advertising, which led to its licence to broadcast being revoked. The two appeals against this at the Supreme Administrative Court have been unsuccessful, resulting in the station broadcasting illegally. Nydahl is optimistic, though. He says, despite the rejection of our appeal, the court stated at the same time that the law applying to community radio conflicts with the country's constitution, confirming the opinion expressed by the Law Council. Kleist Martinsen, lawyer at the Community Radio Authority, is positive Nydahl will be found guilty. The Supreme Administrative Court has rejected their appeal. It is very unlikely that any other verdict will be reached. He adds, Nydahl seems to have misunderstood. The trial is not about how anybody thinks broadcasting legislation should be, but how it actually is in practice. If Nydahl were to be cleared of the charges, it would certainly create an ambivalent state of affairs. That report from Music and Media.
I be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door, to show that you're home. When you think the night has seen your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Put down your hands, 'cause I see you. I find it hard to believe you don't know the beauty you are. But don't let me be your eyes, a hand to your darkness, so you won't be afraid. When you think the night has seen your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Please put down your hands, 'cause I see you.
Media Network's antenna surgery. We'll sort you out.
This is Something on Radio Netherlands, all about aerials.
Start a clinic about antennas. That's why we've come outside. Curiously, people forget that a good receiver deserves a good outdoor antenna. Now, in a crowded country like Holland, you'll often find it difficult to find the room to put up the ideal construction. So, we've decided to test a range of antennas which are on the world market, all of which claim to provide improved reception. Now that summer has sort of arrived here, I've used the few hours of sunshine to tidy up the garden and put up a selection of antennas for side-by-side comparison. This week we're looking at a $50 antenna accessory that's made by a company called RF Systems and marketed by a Dutch electronics company called Duven Electronica up in Hoogeveen. That's in the north of the Netherlands. Performance is offered between 100 kilohertz right up to 40 megahertz. It's claimed more than the frequency range of most communications receivers. Last year, RF Systems came out with what they called a magnetic long wire ballon. This turns out to be a round grey plastic box which fits quite easily here in my hand. At one end is a terminal to connect the antenna wire. At the other end is a socket designed to fit a PL239 coaxial connector. That's the technical name. It's simply the kind of connector you'll find on the back of most modern communications receivers. So why would you want to put this waterproof plastic box between your receiver and the long wire antenna? Well, long wire antennas, or even the T-shape antennas, which are fed from the center, are some of the most tried and tested designs throughout the world. They're easy to put up, and yet providing they're high and long enough, performance is excellent over a pretty large frequency range. On the plus side, because they contain no electronic parts, there's nothing to add noise or intermodulation products to the received signal. The long wire type of antenna is less sensitive to the effects of fading caused by multipath propagation. But there are also disadvantages too. The connection between the antenna and the receiver is a single wire. If you want to be strict about it, this lead-in wire must be carefully mounted on insulated supports, at least a reasonable distance from any wall. Ideally, this requires weatherproof isolators and special insulating arrangements at the point where the wire has to pass through the wall to the receiver inside the shack. The lead-in wire is also extremely sensitive to electronic interference generated anywhere in the neighborhood, such as, well, light dimmers, thermostats, televisions, and computers, the bane of any shortwave listener. All these things generate background noise in the form of a sort of interference field which surrounds most houses. And in my case, I've done some measuring, and it extends about 4 meters outside the walls of the house.
You better climb upon your roof. Antenna thunderprints. Mighty thumbs coming up to you. Fasten seatbelt speakers too.
So why not screen the incoming lead to the receiver? You'll find that suggestion in most antenna books. But simply soldering a coaxial cable to the end of the long wire doesn't work. The capacitance of the cable is too high, which results in a severe signal attenuation over a fairly short distance. By the time the signal reaches the input terminals of the receiver, there's not much of it left. There's another problem too. The ideal long wire antenna should be at least 3 times longer than the lowest frequency to be received. So a long wire antenna for the 49 meter shortwave band should really be in the region of 150 meters long. In practice, in most suburban situations, such a huge antenna is impossible. And certainly not possible in my garden. Antennas are therefore much shorter, usually between 10 and 40 meters. Surprisingly, perhaps, the problem then is not that the signal received is much weaker. In fact, the difference is around, what, 2 decibels, hardly noticeable on the signal strength meter. But the impedance of the antenna varies from very high, at very low frequencies, to quite low on the higher shortwave frequencies.
Why is this important?
Well, any conductor of electricity, be it a lamppost, a steel rod, or a piece of wire, is capable of converting electromagnetic energy, in other words, radio waves, back into an electric current. If such a conductor comes into contact with the ground, energy flows to Earth. Now, if we isolate this conductor from the ground, the energy can then be fed into a receiver and signals with a certain frequency selected for their entertainment value. That's exactly what you're doing at the moment to listen to my voice. But, of course, we're talking about energy, not about potential or voltage. Energy transfer can only occur when an energy source, in this case the antenna, is connected to a load, in other words, the receiver. Every energy source has an internal resistance, or more accurately, an impedance. And maximum energy transfer will occur when this is the same as that of the receiver. It's for that reason that most receivers offer a 50 ohms impedance input on the back of the set, so as to match 50 ohm coaxial antenna cable. And in theory, the antenna should also be a constant 50 ohms too, irrespective of which frequency is being received. In practice, though, the short long wire antenna doesn't have a constant 50 ohm impedance throughout the long, medium, and shortwave range. Its impedance is dependent on a number of factors, including its length, its height, and its shape. So while the antenna impedance may vary, the receiver input doesn't. And this explains why an ordinary long wire appears to perform better on some frequencies than others. When the impedance of the long wire is in the region of 50 ohms, then maximum energy transfer takes place. When the antenna impedance is high, let's say around 600 ohms, then the receiver effectively short-circuits the antenna, and of course you don't want that at all. Now, one way around the problem is to connect the long wire antenna to an antenna matching unit, which transforms the high impedance output from the antenna to the 50 ohm impedance of the receiver's input. But this requires an extra box with another set of tuning knobs on top of the receiver, and it doesn't solve the problem of static buildup. It's often forgotten that a long wire antenna, which has been effectively isolated from ground potential, can be the source of extremely high static potential, especially if a thunderstorm is in the area. Even though the current component is extremely small, the voltage component can run up to thousands of volts, and this can severely damage the sensitive input circuitry of many modern communications receivers. So here we have it, the magnetic long wire ballon. It's simply a compact, weatherproof matching unit. Inside the sealed housing is a special patented transformer with magnetic field coupling. In other words, it ensures maximum energy transfer between the long wire and the coaxial cable that you connect to the back of your receiver. If you use it together with a good earth connection, you'll also avoid the problems due to static buildup. The receiver circuit is effectively electrically isolated from the antenna, because the signal transfer takes place magnetically, and that's the trick. So we've tried this magnetic ballon in two locations here in the Netherlands, one urban in my own backyard, and one country location. It's not much point buying this unit to improve a $100 portable without a proper external antenna connection. I think it's fair to say that if your radio has a built-in antenna already, then this unit simply won't help you. If it's a communications type, then our tests show that these sensitivity gaps at certain frequencies are indeed removed. And depending on the frequency you're listening to, you can expect an improvement over a standard long wire antenna in the order of 2 to 4 S-points. Noticeable. The background noise on bands like the 60-meter tropical band is also noticeably lower. The magnetic long wire ballon from RF Systems performs best using about 12 meters of wire. You can use a longer length if space permits, but frankly, the effects in high signal areas, such as here in Europe, will only be marginal. In the US or Canada, or maybe down in Australia, you might want to experiment with longer lengths, space permitting. If you use a shorter length, though, then performance on medium and long wave certainly drops off significantly. The height of the long wire is also important. If you have to make a compromise, it's better to make it shorter and mount the antenna higher above the ground than the other way round. The reason for that is that antennas which are one quarter of a wavelength or less above the ground will generally be more sensitive to signals coming in at a fairly high angle. That usually means one-hop signals, let's say within 3,000 kilometres from you. Transmissions from longer distances arrive at a much lower angle with respect to the Earth's surface. And if you want to receive signals, let's say on the 60-metre tropical band, that means that the antenna should be at least 15 metres off the ground. To summarise, the magnetic long wire ballon costs $50 here in Holland, and for $75, the same company offers a complete kit, including insulators, antenna wire, and also that special plug. All you have to do is to buy the right length of coaxial cable. If you're interested in more details about this antenna, then we've included them in a printed version of this test, available from us free on request. We have no commercial connection with RF systems, I should point out. Just ask for the long wire fact sheet when you write. And the next antenna we'll be looking at is the new Dressler ARA-60, and that's made in Germany.
Jonathan Marks there on Media Network from Radio Netherlands. And the address for the fact sheet is Radio Netherlands, 1200 JG, Hilversum in Holland. And that's an okay product, technically, as far as we're concerned. So if somebody cares to tell us where you can buy them in England, we'll give that a mention on the air as well.
Interesting stuff, and I can personally vouch for the fact that you get large static charges on long wire aerials. Once when I was up a tree and some thunder clouds started appearing, I rapidly got large belts off this piece of wire I was holding, and believe me, I came out of that tree rather fast. Here's a letter from Roger Marshall in Burnham-on-Sea, Somerset. He writes, I enjoyed most, not all, of Jodie's rock show. Glad to hear some of the older rock bands given an airing. On the whole, you appear to have a well-balanced selection to offer the listening public. And he has a list of shortwave pirate stations, as I've been asking you to write in with your lists. 6205, of course, us. 6210, unidentified French Pops. 6229, Jolly Roger Radio. 6240, Radio Merlin International. 6275, WNKR. 6280, Radio Dublin, he asks. Well, it's not, but it is from Ireland. It could be Prince Terry. 6290, Radio Orion. Jolly Roger was practically buried under strong RTTY and not really listenable. Radio Fax was strongest by far, with the French pop station also putting in a good signal. Well, thanks, Roger. Please write to us with your pirate reports, or enter our competition to win some of the original articles broadcast by Sparks. Write and tell me the first frequency Radio Fax transmitted on over Easter of 88. And you can win the articles. The clue is not 6205 or 12255. Here's the address. Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
Of great men.
Analog EEPROMs store 16 seconds of audio on silicon die, a tenth of the area digital EEPROMs need to do the job. By Frank Goodenough in Electronic Design. Information Storage Devices successfully extended EEPROM technology to the task with a technique they call Direct Analog Storage, DAS. With DAS, they can achieve a signal-to-noise ratio of 40 dB, a 3 dB bandwidth of 3,400 Hz, and a total harmonic distortion of 2% at 1 kHz. All of this performance is achieved while the input signal is sampled according to the Nyquist theorem, not quantized or digitized. The ISD1016 is the first of a large family of ICs and multi-IC modules. It stores 16 seconds of better-than-telecom quality audio. After a signal is stored, the IC can be powered down or removed from the circuit forever without losing the recorded signal. By putting it back in the signal and in the circuit and powering up, you can play it back as often as you want, or record a new signal, before or after erasing previous ones. If desired, multiple messages or signals can be recorded and accessed at will. The chip is complete. If it's connected to 5 volts, a microphone, a speaker and a few other parts, you have a record playback system. A point might be raised as to whether or not such performance can be achieved using an EEPROM, together with an ADC and a DAC. It would take 1 megabit of digital memory to store the same 16 seconds of data. As a result, a far larger and more expensive chip would be required than the 44,000 cubic mils of silicon the ISD1016 uses, which is about the size of today's 64 kilobit EEPROMs. Such an EEPROM solution ranges in cost from under $10 a chip to over $100 each, depending on sound quality, volatility, the ability to record and play back, and of course how many chips are needed. That doesn't include other system costs, such as signal conditioning, sampling, analog to digital and digital to analog conversion, and analog and digital I/O. By comparison, the ISD1016 costs $20 each in 1,000 off quantities. By now, you've thought of a dozen applications for this chip or its technology. Say you're a surgeon watching a Celtics-Lakers basketball game in a $100 seat. The score is 101-101, and it's about a minute to the buzzer. Your pager bleeps. Rather than head for a phone and miss the end of the game, you put the pager to your ear, hit a button, and get a 16-second message. A few additional voice applications include the outgoing message on a standard phone recorder, within a few years the incoming message as well, and next-generation cellular phones. Enunciators represent another area of use. Examples include talking appliances and vending machines, prompts and alarms in vehicles and aircraft, toys, theatre and event information, and hotel wake-up calls. The IC itself performs pre-amplification, filtering, automatic gain control, power amplification, control logic, and the analog storage. The preamplifier's gain is adjusted automatically to maintain an optimum non-clipped signal level at the filter input. The preamplifier's 20 dB gain compression range compensates for variations in microphone characteristics and speech volume. An anti-aliasing filter follows the amplifiers to ensure that the Nyquist response is served. The filter essentially reduces the input signals that are above one-half the sampling rate to insignificance. The ISD1016 samples at 8 kHz, and its filter's cutoff frequency is 3.4 kHz. The signal is passed from the filter to the analog transceivers to write into the analog storage array, which can be viewed as 128,000 sample and hold amplifiers. Sequential samples are taken under the direction of the sample clock at 8 kHz and level shifted to produce the high voltages needed for the non-volatile writing procedure. During playback, the analog recorded voltages are read sequentially from the storage array, again under the control of the sample clock for waveform reconstruction. The smoothing filter in the output path removes the sampling frequency components, restoring the original signal. It's vital that the sampling frequency be the same for both recording and playback modes to avoid a loss in voice quality. Several ISD1016s can be cascaded to increase recording time to several minutes. The address pins can preset a start address at the beginning of a record or playback. With a processor-controlled system, this addressability makes it possible to link sounds together. Short utterances or words can be used to construct longer, more complicated messages. In non-voice applications, very complex waveforms can be created with the same technique. Once a particular arbitrary waveform is generated and recorded, it can be played back repeatedly. What can you expect in the near and not so near future from this truly new technology? Before the year is out, ISD expects present technology to increase the IC's signal-to-noise ratio to 48 dB, 8 bits resolution, and sampling rates to reach 100 kHz. In 2 years, 1 million cell devices offering 60 dB signal-to-noise ratio, that's equivalent to 10 bit on an ADC, while sampling at 1 MHz should be seen. Looking further ahead, 4 million cell devices sampling at 10 MHz are expected. I think we'll be hearing some more of this chip in the future. It's Sparks from RadioFax. With apologies to Nicholas McMillan, but I like that one. Here's a letter from Jerry Hatton in Keighley, West Yorkshire. He writes, I am writing in response to listening to Radio Facts on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday evening. On Monday night, whilst scanning through the shortwave on my Seyshow World Band radio, I was very pleasantly surprised at finding the station. Reception is good. I work in electronics as a TV and video technician and look forward to hearing more about your station. I really like the mix of interesting information with some music, rather than the usual all music or just news. I tend to listen from 11 p.m. until I drop off to sleep at 12:30 to 1 a.m. Keep up the good work. You certainly brighten me right up. From Jerry R. Hatton.
A couple of short items from Music Business International. Belgium. The satellite-delivered music-only station, Radio Contact, will begin broadcasting to the Netherlands on September the 1st. Somewhat confusingly named that, because of course there is Contact 94, which broadcasts along the coast of France, and until their recent frequency change, also to the south coast of Jersey and St Helier. Also, consumer research company in Spain, ICP, in its latest radio listening poll, confirmed the dominance of AM radio over FM radio in Spain. Its analysis shows AM radio with an audience of 12 million, with FM radio half that at only 6 million. In Electronic Times, if you'd like to be paid to listen to shortwave, satellite and other frequencies, there's a job with the DTI. They're advertising, the Radio Communications Agency, for telecommunications technical officers and assistant telecommunications technical officers at the DTI's radio monitoring station at Baldock in Hertfordshire. The Radio Communications Agency manages the civil use of the radio frequency spectrum within the UK and represents the UK internationally in this field. At our Baldock International Radio Monitoring Station, we are looking for qualified radio technicians to join our existing team. You would travel widely in the UK in mobile monitoring vehicles. You will be responsible for maintaining and operating radio receivers and other monitoring equipment. At base, you will be processing, analysing and presenting the computer data collected during the monitoring exercises. The second vacancy exists with the engineering support group, where you would assist the engineering team at base with the installation, maintenance and modification of a wide range of modern radio receiving and measuring systems, direction finders and satellite systems. In addition, you will be testing new equipment and will have the opportunity to undertake sponsored study. All vacancies call for qualification in a radio telecommunications subject to BTEC, ScotVec or ONC standard. A clean driving licence is essential. Two jobs there advertised by the Radio Communications Agency, and that is the usual Waterloo Bridge House address.
From Electronics Times, windy faux pas in France. Whoever advised GPT to give its sales presentations in the language of its customer has much to answer for. A consultant told a little story he heard from a shame-faced GPT official. A GPT sales team had made a presentation to some French customers. J'ai pété this, j'ai pété that, they said in their best French accents. It was only afterwards, when they asked why the attention of their French friends had gone so badly astray, that they were told of their error. Every time they mentioned their company's name, they had apparently been saying with evident pride, j'ai pété, I have just farted. We'll be right back.
véhicule n'a pas l'air d'avoir le passager. Veux-tu me recevoir sans trop te déranger? Mes bottes ne feront pas trop d'écho dans ton couloir. Pas de bruit avec mes indices. Pas pour nous les moments perdus, en attendant un incertain au revoir. Parce que j'ai la folie. Oui, j'ai la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. C'était une fois un étudiant qui voulait fort que mon littérature. Sa copine, elle était si douce qu'il pouvait presque, en la mangeant, rejeter tous les vices, repousser tous les mâles, détruire toute beauté, qui, par ailleurs, n'avait jamais été ses complices, parce qu'il avait la folie. Il avait la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Et si parfois l'on fait des confessions, qui les racontait. Même le bon Dieu nous a laissé tomber. Un autre endroit, une autre vie. Et oui, c'est une autre histoire. À qui tout raconter? Chez les ombres de la nuit, au petit matin, au petit gris. Combien de crimes ont été commis contre les mensonges, les soi-disant, les lois du cœur? Combien sont là à cause de la folie? Parce qu'ils ont la folie. Ils ont la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. Oui, c'est la folie. C'est la folie. La folie. La folie. La folie. La folie. La folie.
Well, I sincerely hope the Stranglers understood exactly what they were saying there. La Folie. Hello to John A. Murphy in Armagh City, Northern Ireland. He writes, very good clarity and audio. I have never heard your station before. He listens on an FRG7 and a 35 yards long wire antenna.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England. 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England. 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.